It is the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer, Kent. Voters in our battleground state, they head to the polls tomorrow for the spring general election with a high-profile contest to decide the next state Supreme Court justice and a multitude of local office elections, several statewide ballot initiatives as well. Call in with your questions about what to expect at your local polling place tomorrow. What's on your mind about the management of state elections? The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Megan Wolf is administrator for the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Megan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. So what are state election authorities and local election clerks doing today to prepare for polls opening in now less than 24 hours?
Yeah, so your local election official, they're going to be very busy today getting their polling places ready. So today, you can't register to vote. You can't vote in person absentee because today is the day when your local election official is getting the polling place ready so that they're ready to go tomorrow at 7 a.m. across the state. The poll workers will also be involved with today and getting ready for tomorrow as well. And so it's an exciting day for preparation. At the state level, we're answering calls. So we're there to be a resource for our local election officials as they're making preparations for tomorrow and to answer voter questions and make sure that people have the information that they need as they get ready to head to the polls tomorrow.
Do local clerks have enough poll workers at this point?
We have not heard of any concerns from local election officials that they don't have enough poll workers. There have been some pretty tremendous efforts from the major political parties in the last few years to provide lists of poll workers. State law says that local election officials, they choose from lists from the political parties before they are going to choose unaffiliated poll workers to work at their polling place. And so we've really seen some huge efforts by the major political parties to provide those lists in the last couple of years. And I think we're hearing that around the state, clerks are feeling well-staffed.
Well-staffed. Okay, so turning to the high-profile state Supreme Court race for just a moment, closing in on $45 million being poured into this campaign for the state Supreme Court. Does that put any added pressure on election administrators when you look at a race of that magnitude?
Whenever we have a election that is high profile, especially in a spring election cycle, our really major concern is just making sure we're prepared for potentially larger turnout. So turnout in a spring election is typically quite low. We'd see around 15% of registered voters participating in a spring election. And so when a contest is more high profile, or when we have something like we do tomorrow, which is a statewide race on an April election, then we know to work with the clerks to prepare for potentially a higher turnout. But again, still in a spring election, we don't typically see anywhere close to the turnout that we'd see for a November general election. So I think we are prepared for tomorrow, even if it is a little bit higher turnout than we typically see in April.
So you're not concerned about the potential for long lines at polling locations?
So local election officials have to prepare for what their accommodations are going to be for election day. Sometimes in a spring election, you will see fewer polling places in some jurisdictions just because there are fewer voters. But again, your local election official is the one making those determinations about how many polling places are needed. And I don't have any reason to believe that tomorrow we'll see anything out of the ordinary. I think that our local election officials are well prepared for tomorrow.
Talking about Tuesday's spring general election right around the corner, Megan Wolf is here, administrator of our state's election agency. You can join in the conversation. Your questions about voting front and center, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You know, with early voting that ended Saturday, can you tell us anything about how early voting has gone in our state?
Yeah, so I can tell you a couple of things about how absentee voting has gone so far in Wisconsin. So there's two ways to cast your absentee ballot. There's by mail, and then there's in-person absentee voting that happens in your municipality. So absentee ballot requests. So as of yesterday, we saw about 503,000 absentee ballots that had been requested. Of those, about 408,000 had been returned. In terms of in-person absentee voting, as of yesterday, there were about 173,000 absentee ballots that had been completed during in-person absentee voting. And in terms of a percentage of the number of ballots that have been requested by mail and have been returned by mail, about 71% of the ballots that have been requested by mail have been returned. So if you do have your absentee ballot by mail and you still need to return that, you're going to want to return that in person. And remember that you, for most voters, you're going to need to return that absentee ballot yourself to your local election official. So look at those instructions that came with your absentee ballot about where to return it. And for voters with disabilities, and this is really important, for a voter with a disability, you do have the option to have someone of your choosing return your absentee ballot for you. So to actually return that absentee ballot to your clerk on your behalf. But you do want to get those absentee ballots back if you have one that you requested by mail no later than 8 o'clock on election day. Clerks cannot accept ballots that come in after 8 o'clock on election day. So you're going to want to make sure to get those back.
Of the numbers that you just said to us, is there anything that stands out to you about what you've seen here in early voting for a spring election?
There's nothing unusual really about these numbers other than they do seem like they are a little bit higher. Although, you know, it's hard to tell exactly what the turnout will be based on absentee numbers because we have sort of seen these changing and evolving trends in absentee. So it was very high in 2020, and we've seen the number of absentee ballots or the usage of absentee ballots go down a little bit in the last few years. And so I guess it's still to be seen how these absentee ballot trends will relate to in-person turnout tomorrow.
Okay. So in-person turnout tomorrow, polls opening, as you said, at 7 a.m., closing at 8 p.m. What should voters bring with them to their polling place?
That is the great question. So if you're headed to the polls tomorrow, first thing you need to do is go to myvote.wy.gov, check your voter registration record. If your registration needs to get updated, you can register to vote at the polls tomorrow. If you're registering to vote at the polls tomorrow, you're going to want to make sure to bring something with you that has your current name and your current address on it. And that can be something like a utility bill, a bank statement, or if your Wisconsin photo ID has your current address on it, you can use that as well. But for anybody, if you're already registered to vote, if everything's up to date, then you're going to need to bring your photo ID with you. And for photo ID, you can use a Wisconsin driver license, a Wisconsin state ID card, a U.S. passport, a military or a veteran's ID, a tribal ID, a certificate of naturalization, or some student IDs. And you can find more by visiting bringit.wy.gov. And if you don't have an acceptable photo ID for voting, you can still participate tomorrow and you can get an ID for free through the Division of Motor Vehicles. And you'd be able to cast a provisional ballot at tomorrow's election. Another big reminder though for that photo ID component is your photo ID. So if you're already registered to vote and you're just going in to cast your ballot, you're showing your photo ID, it does not need to have your current address on it. So make sure you've got that photo ID with you. And if you need to register to vote, make sure you bring that proof of residence document with you to the polls tomorrow.
Megan Wolf is administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, our state's top elections official, ahead of tomorrow's spring general election. Join in by calling with your questions on voting. Bring your perspective as a voter. Headed to the polls, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. You're on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report in the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we have the administrator of the nonpartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission. Megan Wolf is here ahead of tomorrow's spring general election with information on what to expect at the polls, how to ensure your vote is counted. Join in by calling with your questions about voting, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Megan, I want to turn to what people have been seeing pop up in their mailbox. Election officials say the group Center for Voter Information has been sending pre-filled applications for absentee ballots that often contain wrong information. What effect do incorrect mailers have on local election workers?
So that's a great question. And I know that these mailers are of great frustration to voters. They're of a great frustration to me, too. I think that the best thing that voters can do is when they get mailers, don't pay attention to the mailers in terms of using them as an official form to get registered or request your absentee ballot. Instead, go right to the source, get to the official source for the information on elections. And that is myvote.wy.gov. And that's where you can find information about your voter registration record that is coming directly from your municipal clerk. And so that's really the source of the information. That's where you should go to learn about exactly what the status of your voter registration is, the status of your absentee ballot requests. Get right to the source. Go to myvote.wi.gov.
But how troublesome have these mailers become for election administration? How widespread are they in our state?
Unfortunately, this is nothing new. This is something we always see during major elections, is mailers from third parties that are assisting. You know, we see these from all across the political spectrum and from other nonprofit groups. So unfortunately, it's nothing new. And the best thing we can do is tell voters to go right to the source, to go to myvote.wi.gov, or to contact your local election official if you have any questions. Voter information, so your name, your address, and if you participated in elections and the method you participated in the election is all by state law a matter of public record. So political parties, third party groups, they can purchase this data and utilize it to send mailers. But some of them might use other sources to get that data that they use to send these mailers, and that source might be inaccurate. And so you can't rely on the third-party mailers that you're receiving. Go right to the source, get the official information from your clerk.
Voters concerned also about privacy concerns, and you really laying it out there as to what is public information. And this segues here. In terms of security, you recently told PBS Wisconsin that sustainable funding is needed to ward off cyber attacks ahead of elections in the future. Are you concerned about the security of tomorrow's election?
I am not concerned about the security of tomorrow's election. Wisconsin has done a tremendous job. Our local election officials have done a tremendous job of ensuring that we are secure in how we operate our elections. So Wisconsin has the most decentralized election system in the country. We have 1,850 municipal clerks that are running elections. And so that also means that it would be incredibly difficult for somebody to do anything widespread because of that decentralization. That being said, that we have taken great steps over the last 5 years to really fortify all of our systems. But I still think that sustainable funding, so looking to the future, is really important, because when we have 1,850 municipal clerks, that means that the funding that comes from the federal government can be more difficult to disperse. And so I feel great about the posture that we're in right now. I feel great about the posture we'll be in for the next few years, but we really need to look at ways to make sure that we're sustaining those efforts that were built using federal funds for the future, encouraging our local communities to budget for the things they need to make sure that their jurisdiction can remain secure in the future.
What's been that biggest step forward, would you say, in fortifying the security of elections? What's been a game changer in recent times?
So we've done many things, but one of the things we're working on right now has been using the federal grant funds to provide subgrants to local jurisdictions. And those subgrants can be used in local jurisdictions to purchase new devices, new computers that meet the standards needed to access the state database. They can also be used for local election jurisdictions, local clerk's offices, to migrate their email systems to an official .gov account. And again, when we've got so many local jurisdictions, many of them weren't funded to be able to host their email through those pricier services. And so I think this grant really allows those jurisdictions to sort of even the playing field and make sure that everybody can benefit from .gov, not just from a cybersecurity perspective, but from a public perspective too, so that when they're interfacing with their voters and the clerks can be confident in how that email transaction is happening.
Megan Wolf is here, administrator of Wisconsin State Elections Agencies. We talk about voting ahead of tomorrow's spring general election. Thanks to Don from Janesville, called in to clarify, tomorrow voters can bring their ballots to the polls until 8 p.m. Polls open at 7 a.m., close at 8 p.m. Megan Wolf, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Although you need to look at the instructions that came with your absentee ballot about how your ballot can be returned tomorrow. In some jurisdictions, you're going to return that to the polling place. In others, you might have a central count jurisdiction. And in some communities, they're going to have you bring your ballot back to your clerk's office. So do make sure that you're looking at the instructions that came with your ballot. But all absentee ballots do have to be back by 8 p.m. tomorrow.
And what about the proper signature on the ballot and filling out the full address?
Yes, and please follow the instructions on your absentee ballot. So that absentee ballot certificate needs to be filled out completely. So you're going to need to make sure that you, the voter, are signing, certifying to everything on the certificate. And then you're going to need to make sure that your witness fills out the witness section completely. And this is very important, because if any of that information is missing, then your ballot can't be counted in most circumstances. So your witness needs to make sure that they're providing their name and signature, and also their address. So please fill out your certificate completely to make sure that your absentee ballot does indeed count.
Still time for your questions, 800-642-1234. Megan, we heard from John in Minocqua, called and has a question. John's wife got an absentee ballot and recently went into a nursing home. And John is the power of attorney, says that his wife's health has deemed her incompetent. So when John turned in their absentee ballot, John returned the wife's not filled out. How does John know if his wife is deemed incompetent on the voter roll?
Yeah, so they would need to, first of all, not all competency orders are the same. So when a judge makes a competency ruling, they're going to enumerate the reasons why, the rights that the voter no longer has. And so if the judge says specifically that their voting privileges have been revoked, then they would not be eligible to cast a ballot. And you would know this by checking myvote.wi.gov. And if you see that the status of the record is inactive, that means they're no longer eligible to receive an absentee ballot. Now, for privacy reasons, it's of course not going to say publicly the reasons why or get into the details of that competency order. But if somebody has been removed by your local election official from the list because they're no longer eligible to vote, then their voter registration status will no longer be active. But if you have specific questions about that, contact your local election official. You can find their information on myvote.wi.gov. And the clerk is the only one under statute who can make those changes to a voter record. So they'll be able to provide details about where they got that information and the action that they took on it.
Megan Wolf, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Megan Wolf is administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. We have a link also to the MyVoteWI portal for all voting and election information from the Wisconsin Elections Commission. That link is at WPR.org/mornings. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Wisconsin Property Taxpayers Incorporated. It's a lobbying group for property owners advocating for property tax relief, credits, and local aid. They're at the forefront of ongoing talks about the future of the personal property tax, the tax businesses pay on things like furniture and equipment, fixtures. Call in with your questions, your thoughts on state taxes, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. John Jacobson directs government and member relations for Wisconsin Property Taxpayers. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, Kate, thanks for having me. I'm so glad to be here. I was actually just thinking about the last time I was on the show. I was in studio. It was a pandemic ago, and we were talking about eminent domain for bike paths.
Yes,
so
we
I'm
were.
Glad to be back.
I remember distinctly, and here we are now, several years later, and turning to personal property tax, which has really been in debate. Now it seems Governor Evers and Republican leadership in the legislature both say they're open to eliminating the personal property tax. How would you describe this tax? What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so I get this a lot because people hear about the personal property tax, and then I'll get an email from somebody in the general public saying, thank you so much, I won't pay property taxes anymore on my home. So unfortunately, that's not what this is. But this is a huge win for our Main Street businesses throughout the state. So just a little bit of a history lesson for people who are not familiar. Predating statehood even, this was the original tax of sort of the Wisconsin territory, and the assessor, if you want to call it that, would come around and they would tax all of your tangible personal property. So your wedding ring or your bed sheets or your dresser drawers or your chairs, things like that. Anything that you owned was subject to a personal property tax, all tangible goods. And so since then, we've, of course, enacted the income tax and the sales tax, and so the state has sources of revenue from the general public. And so individuals don't pay this anymore. Businesses do. But then when you go down the timeline, you see that manufacturing had exemptions and agriculture had exemptions and this industry and that industry. And so what we're left with now are small businesses. If you think your Main Street cafe or art gallery or restaurant, your Main Street businesses paying taxes on their furniture and their fixtures. So if you can imagine being a small business owner in a post-COVID economy, trying to make ends meet with rising costs and certainly a lot of other concerns, and then you get a property tax bill for like your tables and chairs. And so we've been trying to get rid of this because it is just, we think, just non-uniformly applied, obviously, and impacts our small businesses across the state even more.
And in 2020, these taxes, personal property taxes, raised $200 million for state coffers, about 2% of the total state revenue. And so your organization, the priority here is to eliminate the tax. What impact might that have overall in our state?
Sure. Well, let me just say really quickly, too, it doesn't actually raise $200 million for state coffers. It actually raises $200 million for local governments. Mm. So property taxes are actually levied at the local level, not the state level, unless you're a manufacturer, and then the state levies your property taxes. But so what we're proposing and what everybody is really on board with here is making sure that the state uses revenues on the state level to provide backfill to local governments, because we don't want our local governments to have to suffer through making up this revenue just to get rid of this tax. And so we would fully backfill all local governments and make them whole financially for the repeal of this tax.
So fully backfill local governments. So you would definitely see more stress on state coffers in order to do that.
Yeah, we do have a historic nearing $7 billion surplus currently, and this $200 million we feel is a very, very small dollar amount when it comes to making sure that our small businesses are on level playing fields with one another and with big businesses. And with online retailers, I might add, too, who don't have to pay this tax but can conduct commerce in a way where they're avoiding paying certain taxes, and this personal property tax being one of them. So for the people who are, again, operating and taking a gamble in their community, opening a business, employing people, providing good food, or whatever the business might be, they're still being saddled with this tax, and we find that very unfair.
The Evers administration also bringing up some debate over whether utility taxes should be included, which could cost the state tens of millions of dollars. How extensive should this tax rollback be, and what are your insights there?
Well, I think that what I can speak to is the full dollar amount is just about $200 million to get rid of the entire tax. And again, there were things that were added in statute. Again, we call this a Swiss cheese tax because it's just full of holes, and different industries over time have added exemptions. And so, again, the $200 million would go from the state level to local governments to provide backfill. As far as utilities, I can't speak to that. I don't work for the utilities, and I'm not working on that particular part of the legislation, but I do think that overall this is a great economic benefit. And I might add too, Kate, you know, we're the only state, one of the only remaining states in America to levy this tax, but the only state in the Midwest to do so. Most recently, Michigan repealed this tax, I want to say about 5 years ago, and according to some of their groups, they've seen over an additional $1 billion in economic activity because of the repeal, because it keeps dollars in small businesses' pockets, which they then turn around and reinvest in their workforce and in new equipment, et cetera.
What's the sticking point then in our legislature?
I think that it's all about helping small business, and I've been very, very heartened by meetings that I've had and with my colleagues in the state capitol talking to people on both sides of the aisle about repealing this tax. I think everybody recognizes that we need to get rid of this tax, that it is impacting small businesses, like you wouldn't believe. I mean, when you talk to a small business owner, a lot of the times this is the first thing that comes up. When are we going to get rid of this tax? So I think on both sides of the aisle, everybody recognizes it's time to get rid of this. The big question was, how do we make sure that local governments aren't losing revenue? And that's the next big question, too, is shared revenue in the state budget currently. But we wanted to make sure that we didn't have to be part of that next conversation. So we wanted to support giving these local governments their backfill completely. So that's the sticking point. I mean, as long as we make sure that our local governments are kept whole and that they're not seeing any kind of negative financial burden from this repeal, I think everybody is on board.
John Jacobson with us, chief lobbyist for Wisconsin Property Taxpayers, Inc., as we talk about state politics and tax policy going forward, personal property tax in focus here. You can call in with your questions and what's on your mind, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. John, Governor Evers says his budget plan would cut taxes for nearly 2 million low and middle class earners by nearly $840 million. Why focus on the personal property tax when an income tax cut could potentially affect many households?
Well, we're the Wisconsin Property Taxpayers Association, so just by our name, that's what we're going to focus on. And so that's sort of what we're going to stick to in the state budget. I can't speak to an income tax. We certainly have thoughts on the sales tax. I know that a lot of our membership, they appreciated the income tax reduction, but they didn't feel like there was enough that was being done to support small businesses in the last budget. We're going to stick to property taxes and our initiatives that we're working on in the state budget.
So the state sales tax, though, there are a lot of insights there for shared revenue, the governor wanting to send a large share of the state sales tax back to local governments. What is your blueprint for state sales tax and how it should be divvied up?
We're operating in this sort of double-edged sword right now where levy limits were put into place on local governments to protect property taxpayers from runaway property taxes. But when you see prices rise due to inflation and costs of services that even local governments have to provide, what you're seeing is that they're not able to even provide those services either, and they can't raise their property taxes to meet those challenges as well. And so by providing more shared revenue, I think that we would put our local governments in a great place where they would not have to rely so much on property taxpayers, and they can also rely on this 20% of sales tax that Governor Evers has proposed. And so I think it actually would work out in a really, really great way. I know that leaders in the legislature and the governor are working on this issue. It's obviously in the governor's budget. I don't know what it will look like coming out of the final product that is the state budget, but I certainly hope there is something that provides shared revenue for local governments, increases in shared revenue. What we will not support as an organization is a provision in Governor Evers' budget that would allow for a 2% annual property tax increase from counties and local governments to homeowners every year. We don't think that people can afford that. We think that the shared revenue increases will cover those costs, particularly when the governor has earmarked, I think it was a certain percentage for public safety. I think it was about 43% for public safety. And so we think that that will help cover costs. And then there'll be another budget in another 2 years, and we can reassess and see how the new program has looked should it be enacted.
Talking about tax policy as lawmakers debate the next 2 year state budget, John Jacobson here, Director of Government and Member Relations for Wisconsin Property Taxpayers. Be part of our conversation, calling in with your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the State Capitol Report here on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Tax revenues, they fund government activities and services like roads and schools. They fund entitlement programs. We learn about the interests of the Wisconsin Property Taxpayers Group, what areas they're focused on in relieving tax burden and why. Call in with your questions, your thoughts on taxation, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. John Jacobson here, Director of Government and Member Relations for Wisconsin Property Taxpayers. John, we heard from Andrew in Lancaster, wants to know if the historic budget surplus that is projected to be more than $7 billion to start the new budget cycle, if that is due to an increase in revenue, or is this historic surplus a result of borrowing?
I think it's an increase in revenue. I think that there's been a lot of relief money that's been sent from the federal government throughout the country to individuals, to governments, to local governments, to schools. That spurs a lot of economic activity, and I think that it's basically coming through the sales tax is essentially my understanding.
So really there was this influx of the one-time federal pandemic relief funds that have fueled this surplus. Is that what I'm hearing?
I would say that. I might not say one time. I may say it may be ongoing until people don't have money, you know, reserved or saved up or waiting for a certain project, and that might be local government, that might be local schools who certainly have had a massive influx in COVID relief money that they haven't spent yet. And so I think that, you know, you may see a lot of these revenues continue to be boosted by that throughout in the short term.
As we talk about shared revenue, Assembly Speaker Robin Basso said he'd only support raising state payments to local governments alongside what he calls spending reforms for local governments. Should there be additional limits on how local governments can spend this money?
Sure, yeah. And I think that this is where this is where it gets dicey, and I think that there's a lot of contention sometimes in local communities about things. So we don't, for example, take positions on local referenda. But to get to the speaker's point in a moment, but so what I'm hearing from members a lot is, well, my local government just asked me to raise my taxes for police and for roads, but they didn't ask me to raise my taxes for a new library renovation or a new skate park that they wanted to build. All are great things, right? But they may not feel that the latter are necessarily as critical as roads and police and emergency services. So what the big question is, why do they come to us to fund the critical things at the end instead of funding those things, you know, from go and then asking us to, you know, raise our property taxes for a park or for a library renovation? And so people have different values. They see things as more critical than others, whether that be the park. You know, you may be very, very happy about that. But I think that a lot of times local governments have certain revenues, have to provide certain services, but then suddenly they're coming up short and property owners want to know why. It can't all be that they're not getting enough money from Madison. Certainly property taxes have you know, well, they've basically stagnated over the past 10 years, but local governments also through growth can expand their tax bases and raise their levies that way. And so I think that the speaker is onto something. I think that we certainly would support spending reforms because a lot of money is being spent in areas that would be seen by some as not as critical as others.
Along those lines, state law limits local governments from raising property taxes. And in December last year, the Wisconsin Policy Forum, they had a report found communities are more frequently raising their own property taxes through voter referendums. Should local governments have fewer limits on how they go about raising taxes?
I would certainly think that our organization would support things like, you know, having levy limit exceptions for things like police or fire and things like that. But again, I think it comes down to what are you funding, right? Like, again, if in the same budget year your local government has spent, you know, $90 million on renovating a library and they're going to taxpayers to say we need $40 million to hire new police officers and to fix an aging bridge, the big question becomes, why did you prioritize the library over public safety? You know, and so, again, I think it comes down to that. Now, there are certain ways a growth factor is how they can raise property taxes currently. So if your area sees a net new growth in construction of a certain percent, they may raise the property tax levy, you know, through new growth and development in your area. And so I don't think that they're as constricted as some might have you believe, but certainly we would like to see the state do more, especially because they've stagnated over the past couple of decades on shared revenue payments. We would like to see the state do more to send that money back to local governments, because that's where it originated from in the first place, by the way, is local communities paying sales tax. So some of that money should be going back to communities, particularly when we have a large surplus.
And along the lines of the what are you funding type question, in the personal property tax, Kenneth from Beloit wants to know, how does $200 million get divided among local governments? How does the government decide how much money cities, villages, and towns get?
So we know how much they'll get because it'll be reimbursed. The town would say, this is how much we brought in personal property taxes. usually, and so they tell the Department of Revenue, this is, you know, that they essentially apply for reimbursement, which happens with all kinds of things. Every one of the exemptions that have been enacted on the personal property tax over time, such as computers and fax machines and cash registers, the state government already fully reimburses local governments for that. So this would be added to an already existing infrastructure for reimbursement.
Talking about state politics and tax policy with John Jacobson here, chief lobbyist for Wisconsin Property Taxpayers. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Last week, Republican State Representative Scott Allen of Waukesha proposed requiring state government to reimburse the total cost local governments spend on most services for state buildings. And Allen says the change would return roughly $30 million to local governments. What can you say about this? Do you support this idea?
Absolutely. I think that state government has a lot of property throughout the state, and when an emergency or there's an infrastructure problem or they need their trash picked up occurs on that property, local taxpayers are funding that. And of course they should, right? The state shouldn't go out and hire its own garbage trucks to drive from Madison to Ashland and pick up the trash. But why this hasn't been done, I have not gotten any answers yet. And I did put in some calls late in the week last week when he introduced the budget motion. But certainly it should be reimbursed. If services are being provided by local taxpayers to these state-owned properties, yes, absolutely. We were very, very happy to see that. That will be something that we're supporting in the state budget.
Did this come as a surprise to you?
I was very surprised because I had heard about this in the past, but you know, it was not coming up that often. I wasn't hearing local governments talking about this that often as a priority. And so it did come as a surprise when I saw this last week. And I thought, wow, it really has just been lingering in the background. And I'm glad that Representative Allen of Waukesha has brought this out into the public eye. And we'll certainly do everything we can to make sure that crosses the finish line.
A more specific question here from Allison in Mount Pleasant wants to know if you can give some explanation how Foxconn in Mount Pleasant has affected taxes in that village. Allison says that Foxconn is touted as the largest property taxpayer, but says that their property taxes have gone up significantly. What can you tell us there?
Yeah, I'm very sorry, Alice. I can't speak to the Foxconn arrangement. Unfortunately, we can affect property taxes at the state level, but as far as local cases, I can't speak to that. I would have to take a look. But I would ask Alice to reach out to info@wptonline.org, send us an email, kind of explain it to us. We will have our staff look into it, and I would be happy to provide an answer or help her understand why it's going up. We would just need to have some more information.
We have less than a minute left, John. But as you look at how the budget process is going, what do you have an eye on and what is going to be most significant here as this two-year budget comes together in very few months?
Well, we've seen a few pieces of standalone legislation from our friends in the legislature that we would like to actually see included in the budget. Among those, Governor Evers did include property tax relief for veterans with service-related disabilities. So we would hope that makes it into the final bill. Also, a property tax credit for seniors who are in their homes and are on fixed incomes, as well as property tax relief for our state's farmers on their structures, such as barns, sheds, things like that. We want to provide relief to our farmers, our seniors, and our disabled vets, and that'll be our priority moving forward in this state budget.
So very specific groups there. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Kate. I really appreciate it.
John Jacobson, Government and Member Relations Director for Wisconsin Property Taxpayers, Inc. On the State Capitol Report, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.